hospitals are more risk averse. I think they can become too focused sometimes on the treatment of the mental disorder, and maybe at the expense of thinking really clearly through on what is relevant in terms of risk-related factors. And conversely, I would say obviously a prison are really good at looking at risk-related factors, but perhaps lack some of the understanding around how trauma, mental health, personality issues generally can be understood.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So Kerry Beckley is a consultant clinical forensic psychologist who has worked in a range of forensic hospital and community settings. She's known for her work in developing and training others to use schema therapy in these contexts, and is an accredited trainer supervisor in individual and group schema therapy. Having spent 23 years working for the NHS, she now runs her own independent psychology practice, primarily providing expert witness reports for parole hearings and mental health tribunals, in addition to offering clinical supervision to other practitioners. One of her latest ventures is Forensic Conversations, a webinar series that she co-hosts with fellow psychologist Dr. Jackie Crisati, where they discuss a range of topics relevant to those working in the criminal justice system, sometimes inviting guests to join them. Welcome.
Thank you for having me both.
Hi, Kerry. Really good to have you here and see you today. Can you describe your career pathway for us, Kerry? Because it's been quite broad, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, I suppose I don't know whether I dare say this in case there's any budding psychologists listening, but I never actually wanted to be a psychologist. I did a degree and I kind of fell into being an assistant psychologist quite early on after my first degree. And I think it was only really when I wanted to live in Cornwall. So I got a job down with Sue McGaugh, who is very well known for her work with parents with learning disabilities. And it was really, she was very inspirational to me. And it was really through her that I became, I suppose, quite interested then in the idea about what psychology was really about, and wanted to kind of follow that path. So kind of like most other assistants, was spending that annual cycle of attempting to get on clinical training. So I think what really inspired me about her really was just how her tenacity and how she wanted to challenge things and make things different for sort of parents with learning disabilities having their children removed and, you know, not really given a chance. And I think there was something about that that resonated with me. So going through my training, I suppose I always had an interest in sort of forensic world, partly because it was, I suppose it was the complexity, although most of my cohort thought I was mad, really. Why would you want to go and work in these settings? But I think it was the complexity and the interest in sort of are people that we term personality disordered, if you like. Not that I particularly like the term, but in those days that was the interest. And what really piqued my interest was I was very lucky when I started my clinical training and that the course was very into schema therapy, which was a really emerging therapy at that time. This was sort of 1999. And so they had Jeff Young over before I'd even started on the course. And I think that really sort of piqued my interest. And that really became where I focused. And so my first job was in Rampton. And again, I was told I was mad for wanting to work in a high secure hospital. Why would anyone want to travel up north? I was obviously down south, but it was fantastic. And I think the 7 years I spent at Rampton were just phenomenal in terms of the experience and the people I worked with. I worked with some really fantastic psychologists, psychiatrists, nursing staff. Neil Gordon, I should mention, as a nurse consultant who I developed and ran a lot of the schema therapy, the early development of the schema therapy work in the hospital with. And then after being in Rampton for 7 years, left and was a clinical tutor for a while on a training course. Enjoyed that, but I didn't quite, I felt like I wanted to get back into the clinical work. So I went out into Lincolnshire and was working in sort of low secure hospital settings and then in the community. And that was really when the kind of inception of the offender personality disorder pathway was kind of starting up. So was well placed to start getting involved and develop that in Lincolnshire. And that's where I ended my NHS career, actually. So I had two fairly long-term NHS jobs before coming out and working for myself, which has its own challenges, but maybe I'll come back to that later.
Thank you. And it's good that you've brought up schema focused therapy right at the start, because I think in terms of your therapeutic work, that's what you're really well known for in terms of, you know, spending a lot of time immersing yourself in that particular modality and really being seen as somebody who's worked hard to integrate that into your practice and promote that way of working. But can you give us a brief overview of this form of therapy for those people who might not know very much about schema therapy?
I think schema therapy has evolved. It's probably evolved over the time I was introduced to it and where it is today. But I think in brief, it's an integrative therapy that its roots were probably in cognitive therapy. But I think it over the years really expanded upon the emotional and relational aspects of the therapeutic framework. And in essence, it makes sense of people in terms of their early attachments, their early childhood experiences, using this term sort of childhood unmet needs, and really thinks about how unmet needs in childhood form a narrative for the person about themselves, about the world, about others, and how the child, as they develop, has ways of coping with that, which we could broadly map onto an idea of fight, flight, freeze in terms of how one tries to survive adversity or difficulties that they meet. And I think we really understand this as a model that's really stemmed from people with complexity rather than people with sort of more straightforward problems, which are probably more amenable to cognitive therapy. In terms of, I suppose, seeing it as characterological in terms of personality development, because these patterns of coping and ways of seeing the world become quite set from quite an early age. In fact, my thesis at doctorate level was looking at, you know, children and looking at these kind of ideas within a sort of child and adolescent population. And so I suppose what schema therapy aims to do is provide corrective emotional experiences through the therapeutic relationship and through some of the techniques that it uses to try to provide the person with a consistency in a relationship which is maybe different from some of the inconsistency or adversity within those early relationships. So it can be quite a long-term therapy.
Thank you. And when people think about cognitive therapies, they often think of them as being quite rigid and relying very heavily on structure. Do you think that's true of schema-focused therapy?
Well, I think it's really interesting to watch it evolve internationally, because I think culturally, in certain countries, there is more structure imposed. Germany comes to mind, and maybe some of the Netherlands. I think there's some cultural differences, but for me, and I having spent quite a lot of time with Jeffrey Young over the years and his kind of vision of schema therapy, I think it's a very process-driven, flexible therapy that is all about the attention and attunement in the relationship. For me, we know that from the therapeutic literature that's key in any modality. But for me, it's far less about the content. And I do understand the criticism sometimes of schema therapy, that it has a lot of terminology that people can get bogged down in terms of the number of schemas and mode words that are used. But actually, for me, you can use it in a very simple way to help somebody make sense of sides of themselves, parts of themselves, that really is attuned to where they're at in that moment and not being focused by a protocol of how therapy should look session by session, which it really is not.
Yeah, I think there's something about, I think people often get hit by the jargon to start off with and then get frightened of that, don't they? But actually it's quite a neat model to be able to explain attachment theory, I think, to people and give them something to hang their understanding of human development on, that might make it simpler. But what attracted you to this as a form of therapy? I mean, I'm guessing you did placements in other modalities during your training, but you came back to the schema-focused approach.
I first came across schema therapy when I was an assistant just before starting training, and dialectical behavior therapy was just coming into its, I suppose, it becoming incredibly popular. And I was working with some young women who had emotionally unstable personality disorder, and I think therefore feeling completely overwhelmed in terms of, they were incredibly suicidal and high risk in those behaviors. And I can remember finding the model helped me reduce my anxiety about trying to make sense of why somebody might behave in that way, in a way that I didn't find dialectical behavior therapy particularly helped me frame somebody and hold them in mind. And I think I was also always interested in transaction analysis when I was an undergraduate. And I think there's a lot of sort of ideas that are sort of embedded within schema therapy that are similar, but also probably because at that time I was more comfortable or familiar with cognitive approaches, and so there was still enough of that to anchor me to the approach. But I think I really liked the idea of these core themes, these core unmet needs, and I never really bought into the idea that you could change somebody's difficulties without understanding their history, their narrative. And maybe that's not true, but I think I was drawn to approaches which helped me tell stories or understand stories about where the people I was working with had been and what their life had been like.
I think as you were talking, it just reminded me of that anxiety of, training to be a therapist in clinical training, and people really wanting to have something that's quite structured so they would know what to do each week in session. So approaches that were more structured, like CBT being very popular for that reason, because people had a sense that they could, obviously it was totally artificial, but that sense that you'd be able to predict what you were going to do in therapy the next week. And then over time, you kind of like learn that actually therapy is much more like white water rafting. And so you learn the techniques that help you navigate the raft down the stream, but you have to be able to lean into it at the right time, and you have to use what's in yourself to recognize where to go. And I think one of the things that's really appealing about schema therapy is it does give that degree of structure, but it does also allow scope for you as a human being and the individual you're working with as a human being to be there as people rather than just a set of techniques, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And as you were describing that, then I can remember sat with the Clark and Sarkowski's book on my lap under the table as a trainee, trying to work out how I was going to follow session structure, and kind of thinking, I'm not sure that this is what I want to be doing. And I think there's also a slightly rebellious side to me that wants to kind of throw away the book and not have to follow the structure. I've probably got that, probably a reason I ended up in forensic, is that slightly antisocial side in terms of rule breaking, which I recognize in myself. So I think not having the rules, but having a nav, and I say it's a bit like a rough guide, not sat nav. It absolutely is that process. As you, I like your analogy of white wolf the rafting, because it really is about just hold on, stick with it. You'll go in the right direction.
Absolutely. And when Jeffrey Young talks about working with patients, he's obviously a lot of the time he's talking about patients who are paying for their therapy, living within the community. They're not forensic patients. How's schema-focused therapy been adapted to make it more useful for forensic, for people in forensic services?
Well, as you know, because I remember you working around the same areas as I was when I first started at Rampton. I think I was lucky in Rampton that I a lot of people were interested in DBT. I wasn't, very clearly. I tried it for a year, hated it. I think it's a bit like dogs and owners, isn't it? It just wasn't for me. And I was given the kind of remit of developing a schema group. Now, as you'll know, that there has always been this kind of idea that group is better than individual somehow. And I've always challenge that idea, really, because for me that's more probably about financial reasons always than therapeutic benefit. But what that did give me was the free rein to think about how would we develop schema therapy in a place like Rampton, where we've got a lot of time and a lot of people. So we could really think about kind of embedding something long term. And also we had Jeff over again. We've had him, he's come over twice to Rampton and done a little bit of work with some of the patients who were there and helped us think, I think, about applying the model, you know, because Jeff, the thing I really like about Jeff was that he was always very free and very open to ideas and change. And so how, in some ways, schema therapy with the forensic population isn't hugely different to start with. I think for me, the two areas which probably differ, firstly, I think, so if we think about the therapeutic stance in terms of limited reparenting, this idea that we provide corrective emotion experiences, I think it's tailoring what might be seen as a therapeutic approach in a very sort of typical sort of therapist language, therapist stance, to think about what these guys can tolerate, what are they can cope with in terms of the sensitivity, the connectedness. So I use a lot of humor. I'm very sweary. That's my natural style. So I think there's something about using a very genuine stance that's very authentic and very open and is not hidden almost behind a kind of therapy stance. We're here to talk about you, not me. So I think that I naturally found it easier than perhaps I was told I should be in a forensic setting to be open about my mind, to be open about how I felt and how I responded, and not being following the advice I was given, which was to keep your back to the wall and say nothing because they'll take advantage. You know, this is the induction into high security, as you all know. So I think one of the stances is thinking about tailoring that kind of style of therapy, but the key thing being staying on the boundary with the client. So I think another thing that happens in forensic settings is that there's a sense of keeping emotionally or relationally distant from individuals, because to get too close would be problematic or potentially dangerous. And I found that the model really enabled you to move forwards and connect and stay on that boundary. And of course, what comes up in that boundary sometimes is the relationship become sexualized or feels abusive, you know, the dynamics that come out of that. But those are absolutely the key risk factors that need to be worked on in therapy. So as long as you have good supervision and a good team around you, I find that kind of therapy stance is really key into why I think schema therapy is effective for this population. So the second point really was extending. I mean, I think firstly, the idea of, in our treatment pathway in Rampton, we really focused on the idea of working on early trauma before we looked at any kind of offending behavior work. And that wasn't always the case, but certainly that was evolving when I started. And so schema therapy really helped us find a way of thinking about the victimization of the individuals and then using that as a way of reparenting and healing those experiences, and then that enabling us to think more openly and less shamefully with them about their offending behavior because they had had an experience of their needs being met first. And I think that is really key with this population, that when we go in, and I think still sometimes the approach can be, you're here to work on what you've done to other people. Don't use your own victim experiences as an excuse, which of course just shuts people down and gives them the message of, well, we don't care about you. So we're only bothered about what you do to other people. And then we expect them to show empathy or remorse for what they've done. So I think that was another kind of key in the whole pathway of how schema therapy really assisted with people making progress in the offence work. And then I suppose finally, we thought about how we use some of the techniques such as imagery rescripting within things like offence disclosures. So when the person's into that sort of more latter stage of therapy, looking at their own offending behaviour, how we could use some of the techniques to go back into thinking through the offence analysis identifying where those needs were, what were the valid needs they were trying to achieve through offending, those points of intervention where things could have been different, where actually if we re-scripted, actually had that happened then and you didn't go on to do that, what would have been that been like for you? So using some of the same techniques that we'd use around re-scripting abusive experiences and applying that into thinking about how we work through an offence analysis with individuals. There's probably other areas, but some of those are some of the key ideas, I think, about how we've adapted and extended the model into forensic practice.
Sounds like it was really helpful in terms of enabling compassion for the people that you're working with. And I was thinking all about some of the work that's been done on the forensic modes, for instance, which kind of also allows a compassionate understanding of how offending type behaviours might be a person's best effort to cope, even though it's highly destructive. I mean, is that something you'd also agree with?
Absolutely. I mean, that the idea of it, you had a valid function. If you needed connection, you needed power, you needed intimacy, you needed somebody to listen, you needed to stop someone leaving, that absolutely those needs were valid. That the way you may have gone around meeting them, as you say, are not okay, and they weren't effective, actually. But the fact that you wanted those things to be different is okay. And we can think about helping you find different ways to manage having those needs met rather than tell you those needs are unimportant. So I think that was absolutely key. And the other thing I think just about the modes is also to enables that person to say, there's part of me that has done terrible things, there's part of me that has offended, but that's not the whole of me. Really, that idea of that's not my identity, I can actually separate somehow from that.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice part of schema-focused therapy, which it shares in common with the internal family systems as well, doesn't it? That idea that if you can think about one part isn't the whole of the person, and it's then possible to think about functioning and enable compassion, even when you're talking about parts of a person that really might not feel all that desirable at points in time.
They were maybe necessary in some way or shape or form, though. I think that's the thing. And they were valid and necessary. But I think that point, again, is also it helps the person kind of start to overcome the trauma of what they've done, but also can help staff around them hold in mind as well. I think that idea that they're not all bad, this narrative we have about bad and evil that gets portrayed, which can be really difficult for individuals, particularly in terms of reintegration in the community.
Thanks, Kerry. Like you, I love that image of whitewater rafting, which seems to me to convey something of the essence of therapy, whatever modality one is using. So it suits me as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, because otherwise I'm probably 25 years out of date with schema therapy. And fortunately, I was able to read a book chapter of yours earlier on today, which was very helpful in giving me some kind of more modern context. So are there any patients that don't do well with this modality?
I don't want to be, you know, whilst I'm clearly, a huge advocate for schema therapy, I'm actually very realistic about psychological therapy generally and the limitations, and having preparing for another webinar I'm doing tomorrow, really kind of bedding in this idea of we can hang too much optimism sometimes on therapy anyway. I think in general, there's no sort of type of person I don't think it works for. I think we have used it with people with on the autistic spectrum, if they have some capacity for theory of mind. We have used it, it's being used increasingly actually with people with psychosis. Paul Chadwick certainly was an early developer of that work, but certainly I have colleagues in the early intervention services that are using it. It's used with children. In the forensic setting, no, I think it's used with people with learning disabilities as well. I think it's much more generic than that. I think, not everybody is going to be suitable for psychological therapy. And certainly psychological therapy, which would last a while, which would require them to tolerate quite difficult emotions and to think very much about their childhood. So I certainly don't advocate schema therapy. In fact, I've spent a lot of my time now not advocating for long-term therapy because it holds people up in custody, and we have to be aware of the limitations of it. But I think really, if somebody has some degree of difficulty either caused by their behavior or some level of distress, and they are willing to be curious, it's worth a try. So there's no obvious people I'd say really don't go there, although I would say that the society may have more in its kind of standards, its stance would maybe say, you know, have there are some caveats with populations such as people with autism or people with psychosis.
And it sounds if you're able to use the approach in a pretty flexible manner according to the presentation of any individual.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you think are the advantages for staff in working in this way?
I think the model, so whilst the model is ever expanding, and the latest paper I saw, there was something like 40 modes and an extra two domains and some extra schemas, so we're up to about 20 now. I think if you keep it simple, the ideas and the principles simple, I think it's a really helpful way of staff being able to hold in mind this idea about these the people having different parts, and holding in mind whilst they, you know, as I said this before, around why somebody may commit quite serious offences that feel horrible and unbearable, but at the same time can be pleasant and funny and not all of those things. So I think it also encourages compassion. The idea about if we really think about what these individuals have gone through and they've had to survive and tolerate, then actually their offending behaviour starts to make sense. So whilst we're not saying that it's a good thing, it's not without logic. And I think when we can hold the logic and staff can hold a logic and think, well, actually, I can understand why he's really abusive and hostile to me because he's scared, because he's worried about what might happen, because actually when he's been asked to go in rooms before and something's going to happen to him, that has some really negative connotations. And so I think I'm just maybe administering medication, but actually that has a different meaning for him. And so he's being aggressive. It may also help understand why if you're trying to be really caring and really understanding and someone can't tolerate that because they can't bear to live in their own skin, they're so self-loathing, that actually the way that they're reacting to you is not because of how you are, it's because of how they feel. Or there is an idea around them, they're reenacting those early relationship patterns that they expect you to be. So I will often talk to staff about sometimes you are playing a member of cast on their stage, that they have a predetermined role based on their relational patterns that they're expecting you to be. And at times you'll have feelings which don't feel like yours. They feel uncomfortable, like you're being abusive. And let's understand why that's going on. So not unfamiliar to yourself, I would have thought in your work, is the ideas that we try to make kind of understandable for staff so that they can hold that compassion and hold the idea that someone can be both vulnerable and risky.
Sure, yeah, you're quite right. I mean, I expect I would call that transference, but
absolutely. Schema chemistry, we call it.
Yeah. So one of the things that often made me uncomfortable whilst working more actively was the idea that the residents, the incarcerated people who came to our unit, would have the idea that they had a little box, like a little briefcase, with particular tools, and they go away with tools in their briefcase, and they might have a couple of schemas packed in there as well, and staff would encourage them to think about those schemas that were in there. How do you counter the rigidity of that element and foster the notion of the fluidity of the personality?
So I think that sort of resonates back to the work of Ruth Mann, who I think tried to take some of the concepts around schemas, but really they're talking about core beliefs, I think, rather than something maybe kind of broader, a broader kind of construct. So those, and I have a similar reaction, I think, when people say, but I know my schemas, it's X, Y, Z, and as long as I know what they are, it'll all be fine. I think it's really difficult, because I think the prison service took programs down a line of trying to make things consistent and accredited, as they use the term, but in that lost the essence, really. Although I'm not sure how much those terms that are used in prison programs really relate to the work of Geoffrey Young. In some ways, I think they're quite different. So I do try to sort of say, we're talking about a schema therapy is not like schemas that were in the extended SOTP program, for example, in the way that they're used. But I think you're right. I think when people see concepts, they hold on to these ideas as things, and therefore they lose some of their I suppose some of the power that comes from actually being able to think about these things as live themes which play out. And I often say they play out between people, you know, so these difficulties, people wouldn't have these difficulties if we didn't have relational frames for them to kind of occur in. So identifying them in the person isn't really that helpful. It's identifying relational patterns which helps us think about where risk might become live in the future, rather than thinking it's like a button that is pressed on in someone's head where the schema becomes activated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thanks very much indeed. So can you tell us about the research that supports the use of schema-focused therapy with people in forensic services?
Luckily, I can now, because something was published. I mean, as you'll know, the research around any kind of therapy with this user group is practically non-existent. But there is. So David Bernstein and colleagues in the Netherlands have recently, after about 13 years of work, this has been going on an awful long time, looked at a sort of 8 or 9 of their what they describe as their TBS clinics, which are akin to our hospital systems, but they're slightly different over there. But what they've looked at is individuals who would have met diagnosis for antisocial, narcissistic, I think paranoid and borderline, they're using DSM, personality disorders within those clinics, but also people with higher levels of psychopathy. And in general, so they've compared them to treatment as usual in the TBS clinics. And what they have found, the two main findings really from that, is that the people who had schema therapy progressed far more quickly. So what we take from that is that their behavior stabilized, they were more engaged, they were seen and perceived as less risky, and so were able to have greater opportunities for unescorted leave outside of the facilities. And they also found that schema therapy, those in schema therapy, reduced in terms of the diagnostic criteria that they met. So a proxy potentially for less emotional and relational difficulties. It's always a proxy. I think diagnostic frames can be challenging when we're thinking about those. But of course, the limitation of this and any other RCT is that really it's going to take years to know whether this actually transposes into reduced risk of recidivism over time. But the indications from it, and I think they were right to point out that they have not found this in any other RCT looking at a therapy of a similar kind, is that actually there were sort of moderate but consistent benefits to being in schema therapy rather than not in therapy. So that's really the main piece of research that we hang our coattails on. We've all thought it. But we now at least now have a decent RCT that at least gives us some conviction in that.
Good. Well, that sounds very promising. And we'll try and put a reference to that or a link to that reference in our programme notes when we publish. So you've also successfully offered a private practice service of expert witness reports throughout much of your working life. So you have quite a lot of familiarity with forensic services in both health and prison systems. What similarities and differences do you notice between the two systems, and what kinds of people that might find themselves in each?
Yes, so I think that's an interesting question. I think certainly when I was working in the hospital system, I would have said I was far more biased towards, you know, well, hospital's clearly better, and how can you do therapy in prison, and all of the challenges of people being in custody. And I think that that's certainly changed when I left. I think working in the community, but certainly now seeing most of the work I do is now for parole reports, and obviously seeing a lot of work that goes on in custody. So I think in general sense, I think that hospitals are more risk averse. I think they can become too focused sometimes on the treatment of the mental disorder, and maybe at the expense of thinking really clearly through on what is relevant in terms of risk related factors. And conversely, I would say obviously a prison are really good at looking at risk related factors, but perhaps lack some of the understanding around how trauma, mental health, personality issues generally can be understood in that frame. And I think that they sometimes overemphasize the risk that can be resulting from someone having a personality disorder, when actually it may not be that relevant to why they've committed offences. So I think it's sometimes the functional link between the two can get lost and more focused on in those different settings. I think in general, it's easier to get through the prison system than it is the hospital system. And I would have used to have said the opposite. I actually think the parole board system is a really excellent process, an independent process by which people really analyse what's important, what's not. And I think that that is superior to the mental health tribunal system in terms of thinking about risk to the public. Certainly, I think they can be overly focused on risk to self. In terms of environment, I still think that the prison system is challenging. Maybe less so I know the environments that you were both working in, which are more specialist environments within custody. But in general terms, it's pretty difficult living in custody. And I've also been recently writing a chapter with Joe Ramsden on the power threat meaning framework, thinking about that through the lens of custody and some of the challenges in terms of discrimination and power and racism that exist, that are just so inherent in the system, and how people are trying to survive that at the same time as trying to evidence that they've changed, and how things can be seen as risk factors that haven't changed rather than a response to the environment. But I would also say that the same can be said in hospital, where people can find the environment overly controlled, overly intrusive because of the high level of monitoring, and sometimes infantilizing. Because of maybe the greater controls, whereas in prison, I think the individual's given more responsibility to make choices, if you like, even if those choices somehow feel limited. So I think those are some of the kind of the main themes I've seen in terms of difference between the two environments.
Yeah, that's a really great answer too, and very much mirrors my experience. Mm. Although I always found that I was working with great people, whether I was in prison or in the NHS setting, but I was always slightly dissatisfied. There was a bit of me always wanted to be in the other place until I ended up thinking, well, actually it needs somewhere quite separate from either setting, somewhere in the middle. And I think Naomi always points out to me that this was the original recommendation, was it, of the Fallon report?
Yes, it was. He recommended the hybrid service, like the TBS system in the Netherlands, but unfortunately, presumably for cost reasons, they went for half in each.
Yes, indeed. And the TBS system is a wonderful system.
Yeah.
Having spoken to some of the, I got the chance to go over there and interview some of the residents of the TBS system. And when I told them about how our individuals are moved around the country into different settings, into all over the place, they were horrified that this would be a way of managing somebody in a rehabilitative pathway. They just could not believe why we would do what we do, which we had to agree.
We previously interviewed Franz Dow, who was a governor within the TBS system, and he was fascinating to talk to about his experience, wasn't he, David?
Mm. Yeah. He certainly was, yeah. Very experienced and very articulate, and spoke great English. So
they all do.
So moving on, what's it like working primarily as an expert witness? how much expertise is required to be an expert? And how does this contrast with being a consultant psychologist within a treatment setting?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think I took on what's described as expert witness work quite early on in my career. I think I've always been someone who had very little anxiety and possibly maybe a sense of my own self-importance. I don't know. But I think it was probably the lack of anxiety and the want to try different things and advance. And, you know, and I was offered the opportunity by it was our clinical director to kind of co-work him quite early on in my career to do work for the Ministry of Justice and the Scottish Government. And so I then, I think when you overcome some of the barriers to thinking, God, I don't know enough, and there's so many people out there that know more than me, and thinking, well, actually, you know, most of the time for expert witness work, you're being asked to complete a risk assessment, which is in the, you know, the skill set of most qualified psychologists. I think the difference in the parole system is, of course, many of those reports are undertaken by the prison service, by trainees, which, you know, they often do to a good standard, but there is sometimes it does kind of bring home, you know, how much you don't know what you don't know until you've been around for a number of years in different settings and picking up, you know, having horrible experiences, I think, are just as useful as having good ones in terms of Jackie and I, Krasati, often talk about that idea of, you know, those kind of crushing experiences, which really keep you humble and remind you there's so much more to learn. But in terms of, I guess what I like about it is I like the independence. I really enjoy feeling like I can make a difference. And if I think about why I left sometimes, maybe why I left my job in the NHS, is I started to feel I was being, a manager and feeling like I was having less effect in terms of the way that things were. And I think through being an expert witness, you can have an effect on individuals on their pathways. And I think that's very rewarding. In terms of how it's different from being a consultant in the NHS, well, one, you get an awful lot more time actually face-to-face with people, which is what I really love and have always loved about the job. I think, you know, that's always been the reason I wanted to do it. I think that I guess there's a lot of skills that you develop as a consultant in the NHS in terms of understanding the wider systems, the politics, systemic issues, just having that breadth of experience, which I think then really helps assist you to do expert witness work. But then expert witness work has a whole skill set of its own in terms of managing the legal processes and understanding what different forums want from you, and also managing the anxieties, of course, of getting it wrong and what can happen, which I think when you're embedded in the NHS doesn't feel quite so it's not quite so present. When you're out there as a lone ranger, it can feel pretty much alone that way. So I would always advise people to, one, stick within their parameters of their experience. So I generally turn down work that I feel I have less competence in, whether that be sort of autism or terrorism. I seem to get a lot of requests for work around terrorism. Connecting with other people doing that work and continually use supervision to kind of review and revise where you're at, because you know doing a lot of this work, you can sometimes become, well, I do this every day in day out, but every case is different and every case has different challenges, and so having good people around you, I think, is really essential.
Thank you.
And over the last, I'm not sure if it's the last 12 to 18 months, but you've been running a really highly regarded series of webinars relating to forensic clinical practice. How did these come about?
Well, I've known of Jackie probably, you know, before I knew Jackie. She's obviously has an esteemed reputation, is very well regarded, particularly around the field around personality disorder and sexual offending. And I think Jackie and I have ended up being instructed on sort of fairly high profile cases together a number of times. And I suppose there was something comforting for me about the fact that we generally agreed on things, which was helpful as a kind of yardstick of where I'm at. But I think when lockdown hit, we were having a web chat, just catching up and throwing around a few ideas. And she was saying, well, I think this gives us an opportunity. We've got more time on our hands. You know, what can we do? And we were thinking about different trainings. And I think the idea of the conversation just kind of came to mind, because I was kind of saying, I don't really want to start doing training as such. And I think, I suppose, similar with the podcast, isn't it? And our idea was, let's do something that actually feels fun, that feels interesting, and not too much work, because this gap in our work schedules probably isn't going to last. So I think from that, we decided on a kind of number of topics that we thought we could talk about for an hour that might be of interest to somebody out there. And I think that's really how it evolved. And then we've had a couple of guests on some of the kind of areas such as stalking and transsexual risk assessments and transsexual individuals in prison to kind of aid the conversation. But in general, I think we try to, I suppose, connect with the, you know, with the kind of grassroots workers, the ones who are out there in practice doing this. So we're both quite pragmatic. We both think we have a reasonable understanding of the literature out there, but we try to deliver it in a way which is digestible, understandable, and really taking some of the stigma out of giving evidence in parole hearings and trying to kind of, you know, give practical advice about what things to do. So my sense is that some people would probably find, who are maybe earlier on in their careers, probably find it more informative and educational. Those who are maybe later on in their careers, I think, kind of connect in, because actually there's a sense of, well, one, just connecting in with others, but also a sense of reassurance about it's okay. You know, we're all kind of on the same hymn sheet, really. So I would hope that's where our audience are at. They come back. We have some really kind of ones who come every time, you know, they're our avid followers and promoters. But it's ultimately, it's quite fun.
That's great. And we can share a link to that, but just want to give you the opportunity, really, if you want to flag up any conversations you've got coming up in the near future that people might be interested to tune into.
I'm not sure, actually, because I was thinking about when this goes. I mean, actually, it was after today, it's you know, there's one tomorrow, but I think some of the topics that we have planned for the future, some of them are around kind of treatment. You know, what works in treatment, we're definitely doing one on that, but I can't think. We were thinking around the terrorism issue, but that's something that we're both kind of thinking, well, I think we'd need to get someone in on that, and other areas are probably about around using, I mean, we've done quite a lot around sort of sexual violence, so maybe looking at other forms of violence. We're planning one around internet-based offending as well. So that's some of the topics that I think will be coming up in the coming months.
Can one go back and look at the old recordings? Are they available online?
They are, yes. I should be doing a much better job of promoting it, shouldn't I? So if you go on, it's Jackie's website, which is www.psychologicalapproaches.org. The old ones are all available there for download. There is a cost attached to them, but they're all available because we record all of them. And so, yeah, and some of them that are purchased on bulk by trusts, NHS trusts as well. So, but yep, they're all available if you've missed us.
So finally, the question that we do like to ask everybody who's spent a lot of time working in forensic services is, certainly we had an observation when we started our podcast about how some people can end up quite cynical and jaded after spending many years doing this work. How have you managed to maintain your well-being and resilience over such a lengthy period when working with risk? And you have faced some quite hairy situations yourself, haven't you, in terms of what you've had to deal with? So, yeah, what feeds you? What nourishes you?
I think, I mean, one, I was always told I was going to burn out because I was always kind of someone who worked very long hours and very passionate. It's not happened yet, but maybe I've not noticed. I think I find the individuals inspiring. I think this is why it draws me back, because I think this is why I kind of left management and kind of went back to the coalface, because it's the stories and the successes. I mean, I have no problem with the repeat assessments that I do with people, but sometimes seeing those individuals who've got out. So two individuals I have spoken to about sort of saying I have permission to sort of mention them is, one is, you can find them both on Instagram if you're into Insta, but Sarah Barker, who is a trans activist, the longest serving transsexual prisoner who was released a few years ago, and is incredibly active in terms of her her kind of promotion of trans rights and just seeing her. She's always kind of videoing herself and putting herself on Insta, and just watching how after 30 years in custody, you know, and all the concerns about what might happen, and just the kind of the brilliance, the colour of her life. She's also an incredibly talented musician, violinist, and just such a character. So I think she inspires me, actually. And then there's another individual who went through the hospital system more, actually, Ben Hatchett, who's a boxer and also influencer. It's all these kind of modern ways of being. But he's kind of promotes around mental health through his work, and he's got quite a following. So I think why I don't feel jaded is because I still believe that we can make a real difference, and that people deserve that chance. And I think if I can kind of contribute to that in some way, that stops me feeling fatigued. Don't get me wrong, wine comes into it occasionally. And I do love long distance walking, spending time with friends, you know, and I think getting away from it. So I think when I you know, my social world, I kind of do stay away from my work world. I think it's really important to have some kind of proper quality time away. But in general, the work still hugely intrigues me, and solicitors always get me in by going, I've got one for you, you know, I've got a case for you, because they know that I'll get instantly excited and want to kind of get involved in it. And I'm just so grateful that I have a job where I can still feel that passionate and that excited about it this many years on. I think we're very privileged.
Absolutely. I mean, how many people can say they still have that sense of enthusiasm for their work all these years later? That's fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very much, Kerry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Kerry. It's been a real pleasure meeting you.
Yes, and you.
Conversation with Kerry, and I think she comes across as being a really great educator and a very warm and empathic therapist, and what an interesting career that she's had. It made me think while she was talking about the nature of career, and not just with Kerry but with other people we've spoken to as well, that they describe a kind of interesting patchwork, an interesting mosaic of jobs and activities that they've had down the years, where they've made, I think, amazing contributions to people's lives.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. And I think, you know, for a long time, Kerry was really the kind of the voice of the faculty of forensic clinical psychologists for the BPS, really holding together a group of professionals and making sure there was a space to think about forensic issues, which she did fantastically. And I think actually, you know, her personality really, really was an asset in that role. But the other thing that Kerry really made me think about was the arbitrary nature of when people end up in hospital or whether they end up in prisons, because quite often there doesn't seem to be a massive difference between the different groups of individuals, and yet what people actually get can be quite different and take an impact on the way that their lives might pan out in the future in terms of what they get. So it was really quite thought-provoking from that point of view for me.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.